Okay, to get started this morning, this is one of those classes where there's not a lot of material in in what we're going to cover today. So I'm going to take advantage of that and do a quick review to get started. But we will cover all the material. Basically, we're going to cover Judges chapter 1 and then the first five verses of Judges chapter 2. And then next Sunday, what we're going to do is do an overview of the entire period of the Judges. And the neat thing about that is that the Bible gives you that overview in Judges chapter 2. So it's not like some of it is, kind of we've looked at it and outlined the whole book or the whole period. But really, there's an inspired overview of the period of Judges there at the beginning of the book in chapter 2. So we're going to go through that next time. But I did want to take just a little bit and review. Freddie had so much material to cover last time. He had a lot to get done in the one. So as you're teaching, you may look at that and think about that and think, well, maybe, again, do the outline that works for you. The outlines that we hand out are suggestions. I think they're good suggestions and they're well done and it's been taught that way several times. And I personally like having a little bit of time in a class here or there to review and make sure we're all thinking about things that have happened in the past. But I do want to cover just a few things. First, since we're really, Judges chapter 1 really is still invasion and conquest in terms of its content. Joshua is dead, so that's a logical point to move forward to the next period. But the content of Judges 1 is really invasion and conquest type content. So what we're going to cover today is the fact that they didn't drive out the inhabitants of the land, right? So that content there is it's kind of on the borderline between invasion and conquest and Judges, because the problems we see in Judges are a direct result of their failure to drive out the inhabitants of the land. However, that was what they were supposed to do in the invasion and conquest, was to drive out the inhabitants of the land after they had taken those key stronghold cities, to just continue to drive them out little by little. And they really failed to do that. So just backing up a little bit, let's do the invasion and conquest. I told you there were five things that we wanted to remember. Can we all say that? And again, teaching, I think it'd be good to drill your students on that. Five things they can learn and knock out, and you could probably work that into every class period. So does anyone remember our five things? Central campaign, southern campaign, northern campaign, division of the land, and the eastern tribes go home. All right. So last time we covered really the last part of the division of the land. It wasn't really the division of the land. It was the cities of refuge. So it still falls under that heading, because whose land were the cities of refuge? The Levites, right? So that's still dividing the land, giving one tribe their portion. Okay? And then we also covered the story of the eastern tribes going home. And that's, to me, is really a fascinating story, the story of the eastern tribes going home. And if you'll look in Joshua chapter 22, just a couple of things, and I thought Frey brought these points out very well, but I wanted to reiterate those. You'll remember when the eastern tribes, who were the eastern tribes? That's something you should know as well. The eastern tribes? Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh, right? Which half? The sons of Maker, okay? The sons of Maker were the eastern Manassites. So in Joshua chapter 22, when they went across and they built the altar, right? Now that was an altar that they intended to offer burnt offerings and sacrifices on. True? No, that was not true at all. But that is the conclusion that the tribes on the west side had sort of jumped to, wasn't it? That they were going to offer sacrifices on that altar. And what was the purpose of that altar then? Anyone remember? Why did they build that altar? A memorial, right? To show that the western tribes, we're with you, right? This is a memorial. This is a symbol that we are with you. Otherwise, this river that's between us will divide us, and the people on the tribes on the western side will say, we don't have any part with them. But this altar is a reminder that we serve Jehovah as well. That was kind of the point of that. Now, is this the first time that there had been a misunderstanding with those 2.5 tribes? No, not at all, right? You'll remember when they first asked for the land. So I think that both of these stories, and that happens back in Numbers chapter 32, is the story of their asking to stay on the east side of the Jordan. And you remember what was Moses' reaction when they asked if they could stay on the east side of the Jordan? Exactly. He jumped to a similar conclusion that Phinehas and those on the west side had jumped to, right? Jumped to that similar conclusion that they just don't even want to go over and help their brethren, right? So that was... And I think in both cases, Numbers chapter 32 and Joshua chapter 22, I think both cases give an excellent example from the Old Testament of how to deal with when you think someone has done something wrong. Okay? And it's an excellent example from both sides of it. Okay? First off, you don't ignore it. Moses didn't ignore it. Phinehas didn't ignore it. But they asked him what was going on. Phinehas, I don't know, he may have been a little harsh, but it prompted a good response from those on the west side, right? Those on the east side. So those on the east side of the Jordan, they show an excellent example of how to respond. If you've done something that someone has misunderstood and they've asked you about it, they give an excellent example of how to do it. And I think also, in both examples, Moses and Phinehas, when they brought that up to those tribes on the east side that they thought they had done wrong, how did they handle it? They listened to what the eastern tribes had to say. Don't you catch that theme in both of these stories? They listened to what they had to say, heard them out, and when they heard them out, what was their response? Did they continue to hold a grudge? Not at all, did they? Not at all. And it seems that the eastern tribes were not angry as well, that they explained it, and they worked it out, and they did all of that, you know, nonviolently, without anything really harsh being done or said. It's a very good example of when you think someone's done wrong, how to approach them. When someone approaches you thinking you've done wrong, how to respond. And then when someone explains something, if you thought they've done wrong, then how to respond to that. I think that's a really good story in both of those examples with the eastern tribes. One other thing I wanted to bring up, and again, Freddie did a really good job of this, but I think it's good to review, is when Phinehas speaks to them, and actually it says the whole congregation, but Phinehas was the leader of that congregation, of the, you know, the folks who went to talk to the eastern tribes in verse 16 of Joshua 22. Verse 17, is the iniquity of Peor not enough for us? And the iniquity of Peor, at least I'm thinking anyway, the iniquity of Peor would have been very vividly implanted in Phinehas' mind, right? Because that was, you'll remember that Israel was, I mean, basically committing ritual fornication with those Midianite women based on the advice that Balaam had given to Balak. That's what was going on. And two had the nerve to go to the tent of meeting and engage in this activity. And Phinehas, with a javelin, thrust it through both the Israelite man and the Midianite woman. Now, meanwhile, there was a plague going on throughout Israel. And when Phinehas killed that Israelite man and Midianite woman, the plague stopped. Phinehas shows just an amazing amount of resolve and love for truth and desire to do what's right. And so Phinehas wanted in no way to see something like what happened at Peor happen again. And he, in fact, said, we're not even cleansed of that. And I think that's an allusion to the point Freddie made on Wednesday, that they still had idols among them. Joshua brings that out in his speech, that there were still idols among this people at this time. So, just a quick review of some stories that we covered last time and a review of the overall period. And then another thing that Freddie did bring up as well is Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 to 45. And just keep that passage in your back pocket as a an excellent response to premillennialism and their belief that the land will be restored to Israel. That is an excellent passage to have in mind, particularly verse 45, that all had come to pass. And it speaks of that in past tense. The Lord had given them the land. Okay, that was past tense. That was a completed action. All right, so any thoughts, questions up to this point? All right, so drive them out. That's the commandment that had been given, right? Drive them out of the land. And that was as clear a commandment as there could have been from God to the Israelites, to this generation. And on multiple occasions, let's look at a few of those occasions. So even years and years ago in Exodus, let's look at Exodus chapter 23 and verses 32 and 33. Are you there, Jerry?
Yes. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, the Lord their God. They shall dwell on that land, lest they make us serve their God, it will surely be a sin.
All right, so not only were they not to make a covenant with them, but God gives them the reason for that, because it would compromise them. They would serve their gods. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 7 and a number of passages to read, or a number of verses to read there in Deuteronomy 7. Are you there, Rick, at Deuteronomy 7? When you get there, if you could read verses 2 through 6. All right. So, continued reason for this, that God did not want them to be involved in the idolatry that was rampant in the land. And then verse 16 as well. And you shall destroy all the peoples whom the Lord your God delivers over to you. Your eye shall have no pity on them, nor shall you serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. And I think verse 16 is key. They were not to have pity on this people. Now, I don't know how much of this I should bring up, but I was watching a History Channel special just maybe 2 weeks ago on the military conquests of Joshua. And it was just sickening to me to watch that. Sickening. Because they talked about how brutal and ruthless and merciless that Joshua was on these poor Canaanites. And he did say that word, that phrase, poor Canaanites. These poor Canaanites. And God makes it clear throughout the Bible. And we're going to see a story this morning that shows that as well. These people deserved everything that the Israelites dished out to them and more. And I think that is a critical point to make to your children that as you're teaching this class, that this was not the Israelites being mean as they were going in to take the land. This was not them taking something that did not belong to them. The land itself, God was giving to Israel because the people in it did not deserve to have it anymore. This was God's doing, driving this people out of the land because of the actions of the Canaanite. And if we let our children miss that point, we're missing a key theme of this section of the Bible history, that they deserved to die for the actions that they had taken. They were a brutal, ruthless people who had, and Charles has brought this point out in one of his comments in the class thus far, that they offered human sacrifices. They were ruthless to their enemies. They were very brutal. They engaged in all kinds of idolatry, which had all sorts of immorality to go along with it. But these people deserved God's judgment, and they were getting God's judgment. God was not just saying, I like the Israelites better than the Canaanites, so I'm going to give them the land. That was not it at all, because God didn't give them the land earlier. You'll remember, He told Abraham that the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet full. So God gave them time to repent. And at the time that Joshua led the people in to take the land, they had exhausted God's long-suffering at that time. And we have to make that point to the children. All right, I'm done preaching that lesson now. But I think that's a key lesson for us to remember teaching our children. Don't let the kids miss that. So they were to drive them out. And these other passages are going to tell you much the same thing. The more recent one we'll take a look at that Freddie covered last time, Joshua chapter 23 and the beginning at verse 9. And here it speaks of it almost in past tense. For the Lord has driven from before you great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you, and so forth. He's telling how that he will drive them out. But then notice verses 12 and 13. Or else, if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go into them, and they into you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Okay? So key passages here emphasizing the duty of the Israelites, the reason that they were to do this, and then we're going to see in today's lesson their failure to carry that out. I also mentioned Joshua 18 and verse 3 there. Then Joshua said to the children of Israel, you'll remember this from a week ago, that this is when they're dividing the land. And it seems that already, even before they divided up the land, there was already some reluctance, some laziness, if you will, among the people. And Joshua rebuked them for that. How long will you neglect to go and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers has given you? So we're seeing some reluctance to do already, kind of setting the stage here. Joshua 18 is setting the stage for the events in Judges 1. Thoughts or questions about that? All right. So the first tribe, Judah, actually does a decent job. And only if the other 11 had done as well as Judah did, the history would be different of the Israelites. So they ask, who's going to be the leader in driving out the Canaanites? And God answered and said, Judah will go first. So Judah will be the leader. That's in Judges chapter 1 and verse 2. Judah, I have delivered the land into his hand. You remember Genesis 49 when the blessings were given and what was said about Judah, that the scepter would not depart? So it's as if Judah has this leadership role, and you see that play out throughout the history. Now, I think that scepter shall not depart was more completely fulfilled in Christ. I don't think there's any doubting that. But I also think that in that blessing that Jacob gives, there is this hint at Judah being a leader among the tribes throughout their history, which we do see play out throughout the history. So first, Judah attacks Bezek. Let's look at the map at Bezek. And again, I've added this and kind of highlighted so you can see where Bezek was. Now, wait a minute. Where's Judah? Way down here, right? Here's Judah, and here's Bezek up here. So, I don't know. I don't know why. I think there are a couple possibilities. One Bob goes through, which I think is a reasonable explanation, is that Adonai Bezek, the leader of Bezek, had some sort of confederacy and had gone down to battle with Judah, and Judah had driven them back all the way to Bezek. I think that's a reasonable explanation. And then they took this city of Bezek and they captured Adonai Bezek. And when they captured, they chased him there and they pursued Adonai Bezek there. They defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. They killed 10,000 men at Bezek. So certainly a battle took place in this city, in the hill country of Manasseh, is where Bezek was, in the hill country of Manasseh. They killed 10,000 men there, but they captured the king. Anytime you see that word Adonai, it means master. So you'll see Adonai something, and it usually means master of. So Adonai Bezek was, you know, the king of Bezek, if you will. And they captured him and they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Okay? Chopped them off. And Adonai Bezek says, 70 kings have I chopped off their thumbs and toes, and they've grasped for scraps under my table. Now God has repaid me for that. So you see, here's what I was hinting at earlier. This is a hint of God's justice. They were not being brutal or just unnecessarily mean to Adonai Bezek. He was getting what he deserved. He had done this exact same thing to other people, and chopping off their thumbs and big toes, and just, you know, debilitating them and humiliating them. And that was being repaid to Adonai Bezek. And he died there. They brought him back to Jerusalem, and he died in Jerusalem. Then the children of Israel, or the children of Judah, fought against Jerusalem. You'll notice Jerusalem is really in the territory of Benjamin. You might remember that from the maps a week ago, that Jerusalem is in Benjamin. And they struck the city with the sword and burned it. But we're going to see it come back. Because remember, we said a week ago that Jerusalem wasn't completely captured until the days of David. We'll revisit that point in just a moment. But they do burn the city of Jerusalem. And that is in verse 8 of Judges chapter 1. All right, so after Bezek, they attack Jerusalem. Now Judah goes to Hebron and Debir. Now this is a retelling of the story told in Joshua 15. And I think Brent brought this up, Brent Sciotta, last time. That what happened there in Hebron, who took the land of Hebron, or the city of Hebron? Who was that given to? Caleb, right? Remember, it was a city of refuge belonging to the Levites, but the fields around it did not belong to the Levites. The fields around it were given to Caleb because Caleb asked, right? Caleb went forward and asked for that city. And Caleb also said, whoever will take Kiriath Sefer, that's another name for Debir. While I'm on that, does anyone remember another name for Hebron that we've covered in this class? You can say it out loud, that's fine. Another name for Hebron? No one remembers? Kiriath Arba. Okay, Kiriath Arba. Okay. And that's brought up a few times or else I wouldn't remind you of it that way. Kiriath Arba, because it was the city of the giants and Caleb was ready to take it. So Caleb's definitely an admirable character in the Bible. But he says, whoever will take that, I'll give my daughter Aksa as wife. I said Caleb. So whoever takes that, Caleb will give his daughter Aksa as wife. So who did go and take Kiriath Sefer? Anyone remember? Othniel, the first judge. Okay, so we're going to see Othniel a little bit next time. We're going to be introduced to Othniel. So he goes and takes it, and his daughter says, you've given me this land in the south, and this would be, let's have a look at where those would be. So, got it circled here. Here's Hebron. Say circled, ellipted. If I can make a verb, right? It's not really a circle, is it? So here's Hebron here. And then just down to the southwest was Debir. Or another name for Debir is Kiriath Sefer, right? Another name for Hebron is Kiriath Arba. Okay, so Kiriath Sefer, Debir. And so he was given, his daughter Aksa asked for springs and were given the upper and the lower springs there around Kiriath Sefer or Debir. So this is the area that was given to Caleb and Othniel. The retelling of that story. And we covered it a week ago in Joshua chapter 15, or a couple weeks ago. Then the Kenites. Anyone remember who the Kenites were? Kenites. Moses' father-in-law, right? From Numbers chapter 10. Moses' father-in-law, Hobab, okay, was the father of the Kenites. And Moses, so that'd be Numbers chapter 10, verses 29 through 32. Moses convinced the Kenites to join him and go up into the land. And he promised that they would receive the blessings that Israel received in the land if they would go and take the land with them. So that's who the Kenites were, the children of Moses' father-in-law. And they joined with the Israelites. And they did receive the blessings. And they, in fact, received a section of the land. The Bible says they took the city of Arad, or Arad. And that's a good estimate of where Arad was. Near the bottom of the Dead Sea, go east into the hill country. Okay. That would have been Arad. And that was where the Kenites were. They were given that land there. Okay. The Kenites. They joined Judah to go and take that. Then Judah and Simeon joined together. And Judah asked Simeon, you want to go with us and take the land that's ours? And they went to the city of Zephath and they destroyed it. They destroyed it so completely that the city became known as Horma. Okay? And Horma means destruction. Yeah, total destruction. Let's have a look at where that was. You can kind of see it on this map. Almost have it covered out, but Horma, right there. Okay, just below Arad, where Horma was. So we're looking at in the in the country of Judah and Simeon. So Simeon had this extreme southwestern portion of Judah and was actually included in the land in Judah's boundaries. And Hormah was that city. So we're seeing some success from Judah, right? They also attacked Gaza, or Gaza, however you say that. I've heard different pronunciations. Ashkelon and Ekron. These were key, what kind of cities? Philistine cities. These are going to come up again in the days of David, okay, and then even in the days of the judges. So they attacked these cities. These cities, though, they attacked them, and we're told that there was some level of success here in their attack. Verse 18 of Judges 1, Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, Ekron with its territory. And so there was some level of success there, but we're going to find that they don't really maintain control of those cities at all. The Philistines take those back. And then in fact, the next verse, verse 19, says that they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland. Why not? The chariots of iron. I like the way you say that, Charles. Did you hear what he said? They were afraid of the chariots of iron. The Bible just says they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. Okay? And don't read that and think, well, that means that God couldn't take care of the chariots of iron. That is not what that means at all. Charles hit the nail on the head. They could not take that land because they were afraid of the chariots of iron. There was some weakness on the part of the tribes of Judah to go in and take this low land, not on the part of God. God could have perfectly well have taken that. And we see later on in history when Assyria thinks that God's only the God of the hills, he gets taught a lesson, doesn't he? So that was not God's limitation. We're not told specifically why, but I think that's a very good explanation. They were afraid of the chariots of iron and they didn't go and do it. Very good. So here are those cities. You see Ashkelon here, Gaza down here, and then Ekron wasn't on the map, so I kind of made a dot about where Ekron would be. This is the plain of the Philistines. So this is the part that they had some difficulty with. This is the lowland. The lowlands was actually the Shephelah, this rolling portion right here, and then the coastal plains. Yes. Right. Yes. Excellent point. Excellent point. We're slow to do what God would be more than willing for us to do. Yeah. Who's able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, right? And that power that works in us is the faith that we have in Him and our continuing to dwell in Him. Very good. All right, the failure of Benjamin. Benjamin could not drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. All right? Verse 21. I thought that Judah had already burned Jerusalem. What's going on there? They moved back in. That's right, they moved back in. They burned the city, didn't destroy it, just burned it, and the Jebusites moved back in. And in fact, we're going to revisit this next quarter with David. And David says, whoever drives out the Jebusites from Jerusalem, I'll make him the commander of my army. So who did it? Anyone? Joab, right? So Joab did it, and Joab became the commander of David's army. Okay? And then Jerusalem, that's when David moved from Hebron up to Jerusalem to reign over all Judah and Israel. Okay? Good. So that's the reconciliation with Judges 1:8. Okay? It says they burned the city, and they couldn't take the city. They moved back in. Then Ephraim, I say Ephraim, the Bible says the house of Joseph. So probably I'm wrong here, and it's Ephraim and Manasseh, the western half-tribe of Manasseh. So the house of Joseph, they go to fight against Bethel. Remember, Bethel had already joined with Ai, and so Bethel was conquered, but apparently they'd moved back in. So they go to take Bethel, and they sent in spies, and there was a man, and they said to that man, tell us where the entrance to the city is, and we'll spare you and your family. So he told them where the entrance to the city was. They went in, they took the city of Bethel, they destroyed it, and they let this man and his family go. And so this man went to the Hittite lands. We're not told exactly where that is, and he built a city called Luz. Now, a fascinating thing is Bethel was formerly called Luz, wasn't it? Back in Jacob's day, if you remember from Genesis, I guess about chapter 33, when Jacob went through Bethel, he called it Luz. And Bethel formerly called Luz. So that was an interesting thing. So when he built this new city, not in the land of Canaan, but in the Hittite land, he called it Luz. And as of the writing of Judges, it was still there, okay, as of that time. So here is, if you look at this map, I kind of like this map because it shows you, A, where we are on the globe. Okay, then it shows you, we're highlighting this land. But this green part up here, this green part was the Hittite land. Okay? So it was somewhere up in here, most likely, where the city of Luz that was built, we don't know. But that was the Hittite land, okay? Up in Asia Minor there. So fairly far away from Bethel would have been about right here. Okay? Or actually up here a little bit, right here. So fairly far away. The failure of Manasseh and Ephraim. So Manasseh doesn't drive out the inhabitants of a number of cities in their territory. Look at 27 and 28. A list of those cities: Beth Shan, Taanach, Dor, Iblim. So Manasseh failed to do that. And then Ephraim does not drive out the inhabitants of Gezer. And let's look at where those cities were. So here, this is the land of Manasseh, the land of Ephraim. So Gezer is right there on the border of Ephraim and Dan, okay, inside of Ephraim's territory. And then Iblim and Taanach. Beth Shan should be up here in the Jordan Valley. I lost Beth Shan, but it's here in Manasseh's country. So they failed to drive out the people of those cities. Dor would be over on the coast. You see Dor here. So that's where that learning these tribes is going to kind of help you locate these cities. If you learned the tribal map from a week ago, you wouldn't be looking all over here or all down here for the city of Dor. You would say, oh, in Manasseh's territory. And you'd be looking in there on a labeled map for those cities. And it can really help with your geography. And one thing they did do is they were able to make the Canaanites be subject to them, to be slaves, but they weren't ever able to drive them out. And the same with some of the others that we'll see later on. So Zebulun didn't drive out its inhabitants, and I wasn't able to find any of those cities that are listed there in verse 30. But it would be in the land of Zebulun. So up in here, just north of the valley of Jezreel, that's where Zebulun's territory was. But I wasn't really able to find anything on any of those cities. But they weren't able to drive them out. Asher didn't drive its inhabitants out, and those cities are listed there for Asher. Sidon, that city stayed there, inhabited by the Sidonians, the Phoenicians. That's all along the plain of Phoenicia. That's where Asher was, right? Asher's along that northern land along the coast. And so a number of cities are listed there. But the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites, and they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Naphtali. So here's Akko was another of those cities. That's a key city that comes up again and again in Bible history. But there's Akko, Tyre, Sidon, all the way up here to the north, all in the territory of Asher, and they didn't drive them out. Likewise with Naphtali, Beth Shemesh. And this would be, remember we learned about another Beth Shemesh that was down in the territory of Judah. This was a different Beth Shemesh. Okay? And there are oftentimes cities that same name, different location. Okay? Then the Bible tells us about Dan, that Dan didn't drive out its inhabitants. And in fact, Dan was actually driven out of Dan's territory. The territory that we read about back in Joshua that was given to Dan. Dan was driven out of there. And he went and they migrated up to Laish and took that city. And in Judges, we're going to learn more about that, more details about that migration and what happened there. But they were actually driven out. And so, the Amorites, verse 34 through 36, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. They wouldn't allow them to come down into the valley. The Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres, in Aizalon, and in Shalbim. Yet when the strength of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Okay? So they were under tribute, but they were not driven out. And then it talks about the boundary of the ascent of Akrabim. Let's see. So here's, we're looking at the land assigned to Dan. And I brought this up because here's Jerusalem, right? And then up here's the plain of Sharon. It's kind of cut off. I did that so I could highlight that. But up here's the plain of Sharon. You see, you remember Aijalon mentioned back in, was it verse 20 or verse 35? So Aijalon was a little valley that kind of flowed to Jerusalem, from the plain of Sharon to Jerusalem. So that part of the land there was Aijalon. The Amorites were determined to dwell there. And then it goes on to tell us the border. And the border would be, way down here would be where the border was southward, was the border for the Amorites. Then real quick, Judges 2, 1 through 5, the angel of the Lord appears. He came up from Gilgal to Bochim. And here's one thing that oftentimes we see the angel of the Lord. We saw it back in Genesis 18 appearing to Abraham. Here is another appearance of the angel of the Lord. Now notice what he says. And this is how I can say fairly definitively that this was no ordinary angel. This was the angel. This was the Lord. This was Jehovah Himself appearing to man. Notice what he says. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt. Did an angel really lead Israel up from Egypt? Or was that the Lord who did that? It was the Lord, wasn't it? It was the Lord. And did an angel say, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land? That wasn't an angel who said that, right? That was the Lord who gave those commandments through Moses and a number of other places. So this was, the angel of the Lord. And he told them, you had your chance and you didn't do it. Verse 3. You had your chance to drive them out. You haven't done it. Okay. And so the angel of the Lord spoke these words to the children of Israel. And when they heard that, they wept. This was bad news. They're not driving them out. They wept. And then they named that place Bochim, which means weeping, great weeping. And they sacrificed to the Lord there. All right. Thank you so very much for your attention. And we'll see you again Sunday. Wednesday is singing night.
Like when you get the basic map, where you can all do the
changes. What I've done with those is I have a free Bible program called eSword. You can download it for free, and it has those maps in it.
eSword,
yeah. And I'll email you a link to that.
Yeah.
I'll say I will. What I've done is I've just taken them and pasted them into... Actually, I paste them into Paint and just crop what I wanted and then paste them back in PowerPoint. But I'll email you. You can actually download all my PowerPoints so you can have the cut-up ones that I have. Okay, all right. Yeah, I'll send you a link to that. It's not the best one, but it does have some maps that I found fairly handy in it. Free. Free's a good price.
I've decided, last time I was up high school about a year and a half ago, I don't know what your experience was. I started out the first few classes using PowerPoint.
Uh-huh.
I did have other things. I did New Testament. Back on the PowerPoint.
That group.
Class,
yeah.
I didn't use PowerPoint. This time I'm going to do with the
map.
Before, but
yeah.
That's probably the only way I want to use it. Experiment again.